Dirtbag host Glenn Anderson is joined by Jim Gilbert to talk about preparing for frost and spring planting. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. KBOO is currently in our Fall Fund Drive. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for an in-depth look at co-housing with Alicia DeLashmut.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Co-housing is the place where private homes meet intentional communities. In order to learn more about Portland's newest co-housing community, I sat in on a conversation between Brian Tibbetts, a volunteer for Our Home, an inclusive community collaborative, and Alicia DeLashmut, the president of Our Home. Here's more.
We're here with Alicia DeLashmut, president and founder of the nonprofit Our Home Inclusive Community Collaborative and the founding neighbor of Our Home's first inclusive and diverse co-housing community, Our Home Cathedral Park. Hello, Alicia.
Hello.
I understand that your nonprofit Our Home Inclusive Community Collaborative is working to launch what may be the nation's first inclusive and diverse co-housing community in North Portland's Cathedral Park neighborhood. Can you tell us a bit more about co-housing and what you're building in St. John's?
You bet. The Our Home Inclusive Community Collaborative's mission is to promote, support, and develop inclusive and diverse communities. And Our Home Cathedral Park is their first co-housing community that we're building in the St. John's neighborhood. Now, co-housing came to the United States and Canada from Denmark and is structured as communities that come together around a set of agreed-upon values and principles and are designed to foster connection between people. And co-housing is a great way of connecting and establishing community and support. Imagine if you're living in a community that's organized around a set of shared values, and you get to be a part of creating those values. It's sort of the Portland that we want to see and the Portland that we want to live in. There's over 200 co-housing communities in the United States. There's a lot of them in Oregon, actually, and there's 150 communities in the formation stages.
Wow.
Our Home Cathedral Park is our flagship project of 31 units. We're going to have studios up to 3 bedrooms. Our community is made up of people with different backgrounds, different abilities, histories, ages, and interests, and people that want to share life and be there for each other. You know, think about retired couples and singles that want to age in a home of their choice, families raising kids, people of various backgrounds, abilities, and incomes, all surrounded by people that care. So the nonprofit Our Home ICC is working to replicate this model once this first community is built, and it's designed to be a self-supporting co-housing community and kind of a homes not housing model.
Homes not housing. What do you mean by that?
Homes not housing is kind of our rallying call. It was coined by one of our founding neighbors. Oftentimes we take folks that are seen at risk, our neighbors that experience disability, people that are aging, people that are below median income, and we group them together based on their deficits and needs in a housing development. And at that point, people don't have your back that don't have the same struggles that you have. There's not diversity, there's not reciprocity. You're more grouped around systems and a support system that is paid for versus a natural support system. So what we wanted to do is, can we build a true community that has the diversity of our neighbors that experience disability, of people that are aging, of people that are below median income, mixed in, sprinkled in kind of a natural proportion with everyone else, building more of a sense of home than a housing community or a housing development?
You said founding neighbor. Your founding neighbor came up with the homes, not housing rallying cry, I think you said. What's a founding neighbor? What's a founding neighbor do?
I'm one of the core original, what I called founding neighbors, that is going to be living in this first community. So I'm part of the nonprofit that was formed originally and My daughter and I are going to be living in our home. That's why we named it Our Home Cathedral Park. Neva's an awesome 19-year-old young woman who experiences disability. We all want to live in a community of people that care about us, that aren't just paid to care for us. Do you see the difference?
So is this co-housing, but just for people that experience disability?
No. About 20 to 25% of our homeowners will either be a person that experiences disability or their family member. And we're working on securing subsidies for 6 affordable units as well. Now, our community looks like families and professionals and retirees and people from diverse backgrounds and experiences, all sharing space, meals, and companionship. It looks like neighbors that want to create a resilient community through trust and respect and goodwill. And it works by people bringing their gifts and strengths to the table and being encouraged to share them both to build connections and friendships and to help the community run in the day-to-day running of it. Mm. It's home.
So 25% of the units are set aside for people that experience disability, specifically intellectual and developmental disability?
That's correct.
How did you decide on 25? I mean, why 25%? Why not 50% or, I don't know, pick a number.
Mm-hmm. We want to make sure that this isn't any type of, again, housing model that's focused specifically on the deficits and needs of folks. We want to make sure it's a robust community and has all of the different ingredients to come together and really support the community itself. In our communities in general, about 25% of people in our community experience some type of disability either now or in the future. So it's a pretty natural proportion number as well. And if you think of 31 units, with about 8 units being a unit with a person with a disability and about 60 of our people altogether, that's actually only about 10% of our community experiences intellectual or developmental disability. So it's a really good balance of people with different abilities and backgrounds.
So from your perspective, why would someone who can afford to buy a standalone house or a condo even, why would they want to be a part of Our Home Cathedral Park?
That's a great question. So this is speaking to what co-housing is and what co-housing can do for people. So again, you know, co-housers come together around a stated and shared set of values. And you live a little lighter on the land in co-housing. People share more of their time, of their support, of food, you're not as much of a consumer culture in co-housing because not everybody needs a lawnmower, not everybody needs a power drill. You know, big ticket items can be shared amongst the co-housers. If I need flour for my sourdough starter and there's, you know, all I can only get a 20-pound bag, we can share that out amongst the community. We're there for each other in times of crisis. Think about the isolation that we've all gone through with the pandemic. In co-housing, you have these little interactions between neighbors every day that you can, you know, look out your window and wave and say, hi, I'm still here. I see that you're still there. So we're tribal animals as human beings. And co-housing brings us together with a sense of I'm not alone. And I'm more than just one. We also do shared meals. We do shared workshops. We learn from each other. Maybe you have an expertise in fly fishing, and I've always wanted to learn about fly fishing. We have workshops in our community rooms that can share that expertise. And so you're constantly learning from the neighbors that are around you.
So do you have to participate in all? I mean, is it like that kind of congregate living where there's an itinerary and you're expected to show up?
Mm-mm. It's very much a give what you can when you can. You know, we know that everybody has busy lives and we know that people will show up as they can. You're just encouraged to share of yourself and be a part of the community as it works best for you.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that the community is forming around shared values. Can you tell us what those shared values might be?
Well, definitely, I mean, and obviously inclusion and diversity. You know, we want to make sure that we come from different histories and backgrounds and aren't all people that look just like me and think just like me. That's part of the joy of living in a community is you get to learn more about other folks. Reciprocity, being able to receive as well as give, those are two pieces that are very important to us. Having fun, I mean, having laughter is really important in our community. bringing joy to the table. Now, go to the OHICC and the Our Home Inclusive Community Collaborative website and the Our Home Cathedral Park website, and we go into a little deeper of what our values and vision is.
So, as I understand it, you have an event coming up?
The co-housing group, Our Home Cathedral Park, so our first flagship co-housing development, has a what they call a learn about session this Wednesday evening at 6 o'clock Pacific. That'll be a Zoom meeting, and you can sign up for that at ourhomecathedralpark.com is the website. And then they're hosting a really cool event on Saturday, which will be a kind of communication and community building workshop, as well as a what are the meat and potatoes of building a co-housing community seen through the lens of Our Home Cathedral Park. Mm. So if people are interested in what is co-housing, how do I get involved, what's Our Home Cathedral Park, this is a great time to get all of those questions answered in a workshop that people usually charge, you know, $250 or more to attend, and we have a very small $100 fee for people that aren't members yet or explorers yet, and they would love to see folks be a part of that.
So, other than the events that you have coming up that are specific to Our Home Cathedral Park, if someone wants to learn more about Our Home Inclusive Community Collaborative and the work that you're doing to replicate this model in the region or throughout the country or elsewhere, where do they go to get more information?
Reach out to us at ourhomeicc.org, and we have a Contact Us button there. We're always happy to accept donations if you just would like to be a donor. And we'd love to hear from folks that are interested. We're working right now with several communities across the nation that are doing similar work and helping them get up and running, and happy to help out in any way that we can.
Great. Well, thank you for your time today.
Absolutely.
This was great to learn about.
Thank you very much.
That was Brian Tibbett speaking with the president of Our Home, an Inclusive Community Collaborative, Alicia DeLashmut. They will be hosting a Learn About session at 6 p.m. Wednesday on Zoom. For those interested in finding out more about co-housing, as well as a workshop on Saturday, you can find out more at ourhomeicc.org. Reporting for KBOO Evening News, this is Grace Ann Smith.
Hi, my name is Dr. Mark Allen Derry, and I'm an infectious diseases specialist in New Orleans. Just as a reminder that COVID-19 and the human immunodeficiency virus do share the same risk factors.
Hi, my name is Doc Griggs, and I'm a community medicine doctor and health literacy expert. This is the Noise Filter Podcast, where an infectious diseases physician...
That's me, and a health literacy and communications expert...
That's me, talk about what you need to know about COVID-19.
You can find more information about this show and our other daily live updates and Q&A show at noisefiltershow.com.
So let's get started.
Nursing home staff shortages could get worse. Now, President Joe Biden announced that all nursing homes should require their staff members to be vaccinated against COVID-19 in order to continue receiving Medicare and Medicaid funding. Now, the new mandate could take effect as soon as the end of fall. Now, from a public health standpoint, That's wonderful news. Yes, indeed. Not only from a public health perspective, but from all perspectives. But nursing homes, however, are now faced with a dilemma because USA Today reports that mandating vaccination or risk losing funding isn't as simple as it sounds for nursing homes across the country. That's because some nursing home administrators are worried the decision will cause workers to quit. I'm assuming that would be unvaccinated workers. Now, this would be extremely detrimental for facilities already struggling to keep their employees. Other administrators have applauded President Biden's decision, saying that it is a way to help protect the elderly nursing home residents. I agree with that. Who are among the most vulnerable to severe effects of COVID-19? 100% agree with that as well. Now, the Indiana Healthcare Association and Indiana Care for Assisted Living said that the vaccine mandate will cause some nursing home workers to leave and to go to healthcare facilities that do not require vaccinations. However, they said the directive should apply to healthcare workers in every setting without an across-the-board mandate for all healthcare settings. The nursing facility-only action will only just exacerbate already difficult workforce challenges, the group said in a recent statement. Now, nursing home workers were among the first to be eligible for the vaccine. However, according to federal data, hundreds of thousands of nursing home workers are not getting vaccinated. Now, that's a big, like, what? Why is that happening? Now, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services report that staff vaccination rates nationwide range from 44 to 88%. Boo, those are low rates. I mean, the 88% is a good one, but the 44% is terrible. Now, many of the recent outbreaks in nursing homes driven by the emergence of the highly contagious Delta variant are in areas that have low staff vaccination rates. Whoa, I'm stunned by that information. You're saying the places where people have low vaccination rates are having the highest cases of Delta outbreaks? I'm shocked, right? As it stands, experts warn that very few nursing homes can survive without Medicaid and Medicare funding, which pays for care at more than 15,000 nursing homes nationwide. If workers can make the choice to quit rather than get vaccinated, what does that mean for all the residents and their families that rely on nursing homes for long-term care? COVID cases increased, now use less water. Imagine going about your day and then receiving direction from your state officials to use less water because of COVID. It may sound strange, but that is exactly what is happening to Florida residents. According to NBC News, officials in Orlando, Florida, urged residents to reduce their water usage because of a chemical used to treat waters being diverted to help the growing number of COVID-19 patients recover in hospitals. Medical facilities sometimes use liquid oxygen to treat COVID-19 patients who have trouble breathing, but that same product is also being used to help make water clean for drinking and other uses. Our hospitals are experiencing the highest number of unvaccinated, critically ill patients at this point, as in any other point during the pandemic, and many of the patients require liquid oxygen, Orlando Mayor Buddy Dyer said at a recent news conference. Residents were asked to cut back on water use, particularly for irrigating lawns and plants and washing vehicles. Mayor Dyer warned that if water use didn't decrease, water quality could suffer. The city is doing its part to conserve water by turning off water features at parks and limiting the watering of public grass and other greenery. The mayor blamed the unvaccinated for putting the city in a position of having to face possible water quality issues because Florida's lower vaccination rates correlates to its higher rate of COVID-19 infection. Having to limit water usage isn't a consequence most of us were likely aware of prior to the pandemic. However, now that it is an issue, the ways we can help mitigate this situation is to get vaccinated, continue to wear masks indoors and outdoors, and socially distance whenever possible. concerts, festivals, and COVID-19. From Guns N' Roses to Harry Styles to the Foo Fighters and Taylor Swift. There's a good chance that you've missed out on a concert or music festival since the beginning of the pandemic. Now, during the stress of the ongoing pandemic, this kind of activity has not been seen as high priority, and there is something to be said for people's eagerness to embrace a return of live events to both engage with their favorite artists and feel some sense of normality. Now, over the summer of 2021, a number of live events that took place in the U.S. and U.K. with music festivals such as Lollapalooza, the Boardmasters, the Reading and Leeds Festival, who attracted hundreds of thousands of people. Meanwhile, other festivals and live events have been canceled due to risks associated with COVID-19. The New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival has been canceled completely outright, despite over 25,000 people who'd bought tickets to just the Rolling Stones performance alone, with the producer Quint Davis stating that the decision was made as every part of it said, let's just get to 2022 and bring it back and have the greatest festival ever. So, can concerts and festivals happen safely, or are they just super spreading events? Live Nation, the largest event operator in the U.S., has authorized venues and artists to require proof of vaccination before entry into an event, or at least a negative COVID test within 48 hours prior to the event. Now, while Summerfest has announced increased safety measures to try and mitigate COVID outbreaks, however, it just may not be that simple. After the Boardmasters Festival in Newquay in the UK in August, an estimated 5,000 people contracted a COVID-19 infection. Newquay then ended up with the highest COVID rate in England at more than 2,000 infections per 100,000 people. Now, another point to be considered is that the transmission of the virus is not limited to the events themselves, as attendees may spread the virus within public transport, hotels, or on-site bathrooms, particularly as people come from a large range of geographic locations. Artists have had to facilitate bubbles around their touring team, creating higher logistical costs to ensure these safety protocols. Epidemiologists advise preventative measures if you are attending a live event. So get vaccinated, get tested, and mask up, and avoid people where possible outside of the event. And remember, have fun and be safe. Hopefully soon, we'll all be able to attend these events without any hesitations whatsoever. Don't take ivermectin for COVID. You're not a horse. You're not a cow. Seriously, y'all, stop it. That was a message the FDA felt compelled to send by Twitter. Now, why? Because it has received multiple reports of people being hospitalized from taking veterinary drugs to prevent or treat COVID-19. Now, NBC News reports that people who have been voluntarily taking this drug, ivermectin, which is unsafe for human consumption, at least the veterinarian version of it is. Ivermectin, which is not an antiviral drug, it is an antiparasitic drug, is generally used to treat or prevent parasites in animals. That's why it's called an antiparasitic. Now, the FDA warns these animal drugs are often highly concentrated because they are used for large animals like horses or cows, which can weigh a lot more than a human. Duh, right? Such high doses can be highly toxic in humans. And patients who overdose on ivermectin can experience nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, low blood pressure, allergic reactions, dizziness, problems with balance, seizures, coma, and even death, according to the FDA. Now, that seems like a lot to me. The ivermectin tablets that are meant to treat people with certain conditions caused by parasitic worms, as well as topical formulations such as that formulation that is used for head lice and skin conditions like rosacea, are different from the drug that are used on animals. Those tablets and topical creams for humans have a very specific dose that are significantly smaller than the doses meant for animals. Again, I say, duh, right? I mean, like, of course. Now, the FDA goes on to say that many of the active ingredients found in animal products aren't evaluated for use in people. The agency doesn't know how those inactive ingredients will affect how the drug is absorbed in the human body. Now, the wealth of misinformation around the drug and COVID-19 in general continues to cause issues. An FDA consumer update reads, "You may have heard that it's okay to take large doses of ivermectin. That is wrong." Meanwhile, effective ways to limit the spread of COVID-19 continues to be to wear your mask, stay at least 6 feet apart from others who you don't live with, wash your hands frequently and avoid crowds. And of course, I would say get vaccinated. Because remember, no form of ivermectin has ever been approved by the FDA for the use in treating or preventing COVID-19 in humans. One last thought. Ivermectin is an antiparasitic drug. COVID-19 is a virus. That's like trying to put gasoline into a tricycle. It just doesn't work like that. COVID causes wide gap in deaths between the rich and poor. Can't wait to read this one. Something I've been talking about for a long time. Now, since the beginning of the pandemic, COVID-19 has disproportionately affected many groups of people. Scotland has seen this firsthand, as their records show a significant widening of the gap in death rates between rich and poor since 2020. Now, according to the BBC News, the death rate of people living in the most deprived areas of Scotland was almost double that of those in the least deprived areas just last year. Now, the National Records of Scotland annual population review said the general mortality rate in the most deprived areas of Scotland was 1.9 times the rate in the least deprived areas. However, for deaths caused by COVID, the figure was 2.4 times the rate of those in the more affluent areas. So in other words, those people who were poor were suffering at two times the rate, not only of COVID-19, but of course, with respect to mortality or death as well. Now, in addition, the report also showed that those in the poorest areas could expect 20 less years of good health than that of the affluent. And a quote directly from the report stated, "Mortality rates are normally higher in more deprived areas. COVID-19 appears to be increasing this effect." Julie Ramsey, head of vital events at the National Records of Scotland, said, "Since the first registered COVID-19 death in March of 2020, the pandemic has had a devastating impact on the lives of people across Scotland. But it is clear from our statistics that this impact has varied over time and across the country and in varied ways. Many of the risk factors associated with the virus, such as diabetes, obesity, and lung disease, were more common in poorer areas. To compound the issue, the mortality rate for drug-related deaths in poor areas was 18.4 times higher than in more affluent areas. For alcohol-specific deaths, the death rate was 4.3 times as high, and for suicides, it was 3 times higher. COVID-19 continues to expose the global discrepancies in healthcare delivery, treatment, and access. One can only hope that people will learn from the pandemic and make changes that will better the lives of everyone. Just as a reminder that COVID-19 and the human immunodeficiency virus do share the same risk factors. Doc Griggs?
Thanks for listening to the Noise Filter Daily Podcast. Remember, get checked, get fit, get moving. And remember to get some rest to boost your immune system. And Doc?
Protect yourself and others by staying home, and please wear masks when you go outside. Remember, health is a human right.
Bag, host Glenn Anderson is joined by Jim Gilbert to talk about preparing for frost and spring planting. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. KBOO is currently in our fall fund drive. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for an in-depth look at co-housing with Alicia DeLashmut.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Co-housing is the place where private homes meet intentional communities. In order to learn more about Portland's newest co-housing community, I sat in on a conversation between Brian Tibbetts, a volunteer for Our Home, an inclusive community collaborative, and Alicia DeLashmut, the president of Our Home. Here's more.
We're here with Alicia DeLashmut, president and founder of the nonprofit Our Home Inclusive Community Collaborative and the founding neighbor of Our Home's first inclusive and diverse co-housing community, Our Home Cathedral Park. Hello, Alicia.
Hello.
I understand that your nonprofit Our Home Inclusive Community Collaborative is working to launch what may be the nation's first inclusive and diverse co-housing community in North Portland's Cathedral Park neighborhood. Can you tell us a bit more about co-housing and what you're building in St. John's?
You bet. The Our Home Inclusive Community Collaborative's mission is to promote, support, and develop inclusive and diverse communities. And Our Home Cathedral Park is their first co-housing community that we're building in the St. John's neighborhood. Now, co-housing came to the United States and Canada from Denmark and is structured as communities that come together around a set of agreed-upon values and principles and are designed to foster connection between people. And co-housing is a great way of connecting and establishing community and support. Imagine if you're living in a community that's organized around a set of shared values, and you get to be a part of creating those values. It's sort of the Portland that we want to see and the Portland that we want to live in. There's over 200 co-housing communities in the United States. There's a lot of them in Oregon, actually, and there's 150 communities in the formation stages.
Wow.
Our Home Cathedral Park is our flagship project of 31 units. We're going to have studios up to 3 bedrooms. Our community is made up of people with different backgrounds, different abilities, histories, ages, and interests, and people that want to share life and be there for each other. You know, think about retired couples and singles that want to age in a home of their choice, families raising kids, people of various backgrounds, abilities, and incomes, all surrounded by people that care. So the nonprofit Our Home ICC is working to replicate this model once this first community is built, and it's designed to be a self-supporting co-housing community and kind of a homes not housing model.
Homes not housing, what do you mean by that?
Homes not housing is kind of our rallying call. It was coined by one of our founding neighbors. Oftentimes we take folks that are seen at risk, our neighbors that experience disability, people that are aging, people that are below median income, and we group them together based on their deficits and needs in a housing development. And at that point, people don't have your back that don't have the same struggles that you have. It's not, there's not diversity, there's not reciprocity. You're more grouped around systems and a support system that is paid for versus a natural support system. So what we wanted to do is, can we build a true community that has the diversity of our neighbors that experience disability, of people that are aging, of people that are below median income, mixed in, sprinkled in kind of a natural proportion with everyone else, building more of a sense of home than a housing community or a housing development?
You said founding neighbor. Your founding neighbor came up with the homes, not housing rallying cry, I think you said. What's a founding neighbor? What's a founding neighbor do?
I'm one of the core original, what I called founding neighbors, that is going to be living in this first community. So I'm part of the nonprofit that was formed originally, and My daughter and I are going to be living in our home. That's why we named it Our Home Cathedral Park. Neva's an awesome 19-year-old young woman who experiences disability. We all want to live in a community of people that care about us, that aren't just paid to care for us. Do you see the difference?
So is this co-housing, but just for people that experience disability?
No. About 20 to 25% of our homeowners will either be a person that experiences disability or their family member. And we're working on securing subsidies for 6 affordable units as well. Now, our community looks like families and professionals and retirees and people from diverse backgrounds and experiences, all sharing space, meals, and companionship. It looks like neighbors that want to create a resilient community through trust and respect and goodwill. And it works by people bringing their gifts and strengths to the table and being encouraged to share them both to build connections and friendships and to help the community run in the day-to-day running of it. Mm. It's home.
So 25% of the units are set aside for people that experience disability, specifically intellectual and developmental disability?
That's correct.
How did you decide on 25? I mean, why 25%? Why not 50% or, I don't know, pick a number.
Mm-hmm. We want to make sure that this isn't any type of, again, housing model that's focused specifically on the deficits and needs of folks. We want to make sure it's a robust community and has all of the different ingredients to come together and really support the community itself. In our communities in general, about 25% of people in our community experience some type of disability, either now or in the future. So it's a pretty natural proportion number as well. And if you think of 31 units, with about 8 units being a unit with a person with a disability, and about 60 of our people altogether, that's actually only about 10% of our community experiences intellectual or developmental disability. So it's a really good balance of people with different abilities and backgrounds.
So, from your perspective, why would someone who can afford to buy a standalone house or a condo even, why would they want to be a part of our home, Cathedral Park?
That's a great question. So this is speaking to what co-housing is and what co-housing can do for people. So again, you know, co-housers come together around a stated and shared set of values. And you live a little lighter on the land in co-housing. People share more of their time, of their support, of food, you're not as much of a consumer culture in co-housing because not everybody needs a lawnmower, not everybody needs a power drill. You know, big ticket items can be shared amongst the co-housers. If I need flour for my sourdough starter and there's, you know, all I can only get a 20-pound bag, we can share that out amongst the community. We're there for each other in times of crisis. Think about the isolation that we've all gone through with the pandemic. In co-housing, you have these little interactions between neighbors every day that you can, you know, look out your window and wave and say, hi, I'm still here. I see that you're still there. So we're tribal animals as human beings. And co-housing brings us together with a sense of I'm not alone. And I'm more than just one. We also do shared meals. We do shared workshops. We learn from each other. Maybe you have an expertise in fly fishing, and I've always wanted to learn about fly fishing. We have workshops in our community rooms that can share that expertise. And so you're constantly learning from the neighbors that are around you.
So do you have to participate in all? I mean, is it like that kind of congregate living where there's an itinerary and you're expected to show up?
Mm-mm. It's very much a give what you can when you can. You know, we know that everybody has busy lives and we know that people will show up as they can. You're just encouraged to share of yourself and be a part of the community as it works best for you.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that the community is forming around shared values. Can you tell us what those shared values might be?
Well, definitely, I mean, and obviously inclusion and diversity. You know, we want to make sure that we come from different histories and backgrounds and aren't all people that look just like me and think just like me. That's part of the joy of living in a community is you get to learn more about other folks. Reciprocity, being able to receive as well as give, those are two pieces that are very important to us. Having fun, I mean, having laughter is really important in our community. bringing joy to the table. Go to the OHICC and the Our Home Inclusive Community Collaborative website and the Our Home Cathedral Park website, and we go into a little deeper of what our values and vision is.
So as I understand it, you have an event coming up?
The co-housing group, Our Home Cathedral Park, so our first flagship co-housing development, has what they call a learn about session this Wednesday evening at 6:00 Pacific. That'll be a Zoom meeting, and you can sign up for that at ourhomecathedralpark.com is the website. And then they're hosting a really cool event on Saturday, which will be a kind of communication and community building workshop, as well as a what are the meat and potatoes of building a co-housing community seen through the lens of Our Home Cathedral Park. Mm. So if people are interested in what is co-housing, how do I get involved, what's Our Home Cathedral Park, this is a great time to get all of those questions answered in a workshop that people usually charge, $250 or more to attend, and we have a very small $100 fee for people that aren't members yet or explorers yet, and they would love to see folks be a part of that.
So, other than the events that you have coming up that are specific to Our Home Cathedral Park, if someone wants to learn more about Our Home Inclusive Community Collaborative and the work that you're doing to replicate this model in the region or throughout the country or elsewhere, where do they go to get more information?
Reach out to us at ourhomeicc.org, and we have a Contact Us button there. We're always happy to accept donations if you just would like to be a donor. And we'd love to hear from folks that are interested. We're working right now with several communities across the nation that are doing similar work and helping them get up and running, and happy to help out in any way that we can.
Great. Well, thank you for your time today.
Absolutely.
This was great to learn about all this.
Thank you very much.
That was Brian Tibbett speaking with the president of Our Home, an Inclusive Community Collaborative, Alicia DeLashmut. They will be hosting a Learn About session at 6 p.m. Wednesday on Zoom. For those interested in finding out more about co-housing, as well as a workshop on Saturday, you can find out more at ourhomeicc.org. Reporting for KBOO Evening News, this is Grace Ann Smith.
Hi, my name is Dr. Mark Allen Derry, and I'm an infectious diseases specialist in New Orleans. Just as a reminder that COVID-19 and the human immunodeficiency virus do share the same risk factors.
Hi, my name is Doc Griggs, and I'm a community medicine doctor and health literacy expert. This is the Noise Filter Podcast, where an infectious diseases physician,
that's me, and a health literacy and communications expert,
that's me, talk about what you need to know about COVID-19.
You can find more information about this show and our other daily live updates and Q&A show at noisefiltershow.com.
So let's get started.
Nursing home staff shortages could get worse. Now, President Joe Biden announced that all nursing homes should require their staff members to be vaccinated against COVID-19 in order to continue receiving Medicare and Medicaid funding. Now, the new mandate could take effect as soon as the end of fall. Now, from a public health standpoint, That's wonderful news. Yes, indeed. Not only from a public health perspective, but from all perspectives. But nursing homes, however, are now faced with a dilemma because USA Today reports that mandating vaccination or risk losing funding isn't as simple as it sounds for nursing homes across the country. That's because some nursing home administrators are worried the decision will cause workers to quit. I'm assuming that would be unvaccinated workers. Now, this would be extremely detrimental for facilities already struggling to keep their employees. Other administrators have applauded President Biden's decision, saying that it is a way to help protect the elderly nursing home residents. I agree with that. Who are among the most vulnerable to severe effects of COVID-19? 100% agree with that as well. Now, the Indiana Healthcare Association and Indiana Care for Assisted Living said that the vaccine mandate will cause some nursing home workers to leave and to go to healthcare facilities that do not require vaccinations. However, they said the directive should apply to healthcare workers in every setting without an across-the-board mandate for all healthcare settings. The nursing facility-only action will only just exacerbate already difficult workforce challenges, the group said in a recent statement. Now, nursing home workers were among the first to be eligible for the vaccine. However, according to federal data, hundreds of thousands of nursing home workers are not getting vaccinated. Now, that's a big, like, what? Why is that happening? Now, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services report that staff vaccination rates nationwide range from 44 to 88%. Boo, those are low rates. I mean, the 88% is a good one, but the 44% is terrible. Now, many of the recent outbreaks in nursing homes, driven by the emergence of the highly contagious Delta variant, are in areas that have low staff vaccination rates. Whoa, I'm stunned by that information. You're saying the places where people have low vaccination rates are having the highest cases of Delta outbreaks? I'm shocked, right? As it stands, experts warn that very few nursing homes can survive without Medicaid and Medicare funding, which pays for care at more than 15,000 nursing homes nationwide. If workers can make the choice to quit rather than get vaccinated, what does that mean for all of the residents and their families that rely on nursing homes for long-term care? COVID cases increased, now use less water. Imagine going about your day and then receiving direction from your state officials to use less water because of COVID. It may sound strange, but that is exactly what is happening to Florida residents. According to NBC News, officials in Orlando, Florida, urged residents to reduce their water usage because of a chemical used to treat waters being diverted to help the growing number of COVID-19 patients recover in hospitals. Medical facilities sometimes use liquid oxygen to treat COVID-19 patients who have trouble breathing, but that same product is also being used to help make water clean for drinking and other uses. Our hospitals are experiencing the highest number of unvaccinated, critically ill patients at this point, as in any other point during the pandemic, and many of the patients require liquid oxygen, Orlando Mayor Buddy Dyer said at a recent news conference. Residents were asked to cut back on water use, particularly for irrigating lawns and plants and washing vehicles. Mayor Dyer warned that if water use didn't decrease, water quality could suffer. The city is doing its part to conserve water by turning off water features at parks and limiting the watering of public grass and other greenery. The mayor blamed the unvaccinated for putting the city in a position of having to face possible water quality issues because Florida's lower vaccination rates correlates to its higher rate of COVID-19 infection. Having to limit water usage isn't a consequence most of us were likely aware of prior to the pandemic. However, now that it is an issue, the ways we can help mitigate this situation is to get vaccinated, continue to wear masks indoors and outdoors, and socially distance whenever possible. concerts, festivals, and COVID-19. From Guns N' Roses to Harry Styles to the Foo Fighters and Taylor Swift. There's a good chance that you've missed out on a concert or music festival since the beginning of the pandemic. Now, during the stress of the ongoing pandemic, this kind of activity has not been seen as high priority, and there is something to be said for people's eagerness to embrace a return of live events to both engage with their favorite artists and feel some sense of normality. Now, over the summer of 2021, the number of live events that took place in the U.S. and U.K. with music festivals such as Lollapalooza, the Boardmasters, the Reading and Leeds Festival, who attracted hundreds of thousands of people. Meanwhile, other festivals and live events have been canceled due to risks associated with COVID-19. The New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival has been canceled completely outright, despite over 25,000 people who'd bought tickets to just the Rolling Stones performance alone, with the producer Quentin Davis stating that the decision was made as every part of it said, let's just get to 2022 and bring it back and have the greatest festival ever. So, can concerts and festivals happen safely, or are they just super spreading events? Live Nation, the largest event operator in the U.S., has authorized venues and artists to require proof of vaccination before entry into an event, or at least a negative COVID test within 48 hours prior to the event. Now, while Summerfest has announced increased safety measures to try and mitigate COVID outbreaks, however, it just may not be that simple. After the Boardmasters Festival in Newquay in the U.K., in August, an estimated 5,000 people contracted a COVID-19 infection. Newquay then ended up with the highest COVID rate in England at more than 2,000 infections per 100,000 people. Now, another point to be considered is that the transmission of the virus is not limited to the events themselves, as attendees may spread the virus within public transport, hotels, or on-site bathrooms, particularly as people come from a large range of geographic locations. Artists have had to facilitate bubbles around their touring team, creating higher logistical costs to ensure these safety protocols. Epidemiologists advise preventative measures if you are attending a live event. So get vaccinated, get tested, and mask up, and avoid people where possible outside of the event. And remember, have fun and be safe. Hopefully soon, we'll all be able to attend these events without any hesitations whatsoever. Don't take ivermectin for COVID. You're not a horse. You're not a cow. Seriously, y'all, stop it. That was a message the FDA felt compelled to send by Twitter. Now, why? Because it has received multiple reports of people being hospitalized from taking veterinary drugs to prevent or treat COVID-19. Now, NBC News reports that people who have been voluntarily taking this drug, ivermectin, which is unsafe for human consumption, at least the veterinarian version of it is. Ivermectin, which is not an antiviral drug, it is an antiparasitic drug, is generally used to treat or prevent parasites in animals. That's why it's called an antiparasitic. Now, the FDA warns these animal drugs are often highly concentrated because they are used for large animals like horses or cows, which can weigh a lot more than a human. Duh, right? Such high doses can be highly toxic in humans. And patients who overdose on ivermectin can experience nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, low blood pressure, allergic reactions, dizziness, problems with balance, seizures, coma, and even death, according to the FDA. Now, that seems like a lot to me. The ivermectin tablets that are meant to treat people with certain conditions caused by parasitic worms, as well as topical formulations such as that formulation that is used for head lice and skin conditions like rosacea, are different from the drug that are used on animals. Those tablets and topical creams for humans have a very specific dose that are significantly smaller than the doses meant for animals. Again, I say, duh, right? I mean, like, of course. Now, the FDA goes on to say that many of the active ingredients found in animal products aren't evaluated for use in people. The agency doesn't know how those inactive ingredients will affect how the drug is absorbed in the human body. Now, the wealth of misinformation around the drug and COVID-19 in general continues to cause issues. An FDA consumer update reads, "You may have heard that it's okay to take large doses of ivermectin. That is wrong." Meanwhile, effective ways to limit the spread of COVID-19 continues to be to wear your mask, stay at least 6 feet apart from others who you don't live with, wash your hands frequently and avoid crowds. And of course, I would say get vaccinated. Because remember, no form of ivermectin has ever been approved by the FDA for the use in treating or preventing COVID-19 in humans. One last thought. Ivermectin is an antiparasitic drug. COVID-19 is a virus. That's like trying to put gasoline into a tricycle. It just doesn't work like that. COVID causes wide gap in deaths between the rich and poor. Can't wait to read this one. Something I've been talking about for a long time. Now, since the beginning of the pandemic, COVID-19 has disproportionately affected many groups of people. Scotland has seen this firsthand, as their records show a significant widening of the gap in death rates between rich and poor since 2020. Now, according to the BBC News, the death rate of people living in the most deprived areas of Scotland was almost double that of those in the least deprived areas just last year. Now, the National Records of Scotland annual population review said the general mortality rate in the most deprived areas of Scotland was 1.9 times the rate in the least deprived areas. However, for deaths caused by COVID, the figure was 2.4 times the rate of those in the more affluent areas. So in other words, those people who were poor were suffering at two times the rate, not only of COVID-19, but of course, with respect to mortality or death as well. Now, in addition, the report also showed that those in the poorest areas could expect 20 less years of good health than that of the affluent. And a quote directly from the report stated, "Mortality rates are normally higher in more deprived areas. COVID-19 appears to be increasing this effect." Julie Ramsey, head of vital events at the National Records of Scotland, said, "Since the first registered COVID-19 death in March of 2020, the pandemic has had a devastating impact on the lives of people across Scotland. But it is clear from our statistics that this impact has varied over time and across the country and in varied ways. Many of the risk factors associated with the virus, such as diabetes, obesity, and lung disease, were more common in poorer areas. To compound the issue, the mortality rate for drug-related deaths in poor areas was 18.4 times higher than in more affluent areas. For alcohol-specific deaths, the death rate was 4.3 times as high, and for suicides, it was 3 times higher. COVID-19 continues to expose the global discrepancies in healthcare delivery, treatment, and access. One can only hope that people will learn from the pandemic and make changes that will better the lives of everyone.
Just as a reminder that COVID-19 and the human immunodeficiency virus do share the same risk factors. Doc Griggs.
Thanks for listening to the Noise Filter Daily Podcast. Remember, get checked, get fit, get moving. And remember to get some rest to boost your immune system. And Doc,
protect yourself and others by staying home, and please wear masks when you go outside. Remember, health is a human right.